Oh, we never even talked about Giant. Jeez. So Brock.
Yeah, the big one. Yeah.
That's how he and Elizabeth became really great friends.
Right. Giant is important for Rock Hudson on so many different levels. I mean, this is he begged Universal to loan him out to Warner Brothers to do this one picture. Big prestige film with George Stevens as the director, and it's based on this sweeping bestseller by Edna Ferber. And, you know, it's the character of Bic Benedict, which Rock got to play, and a lot of actors were vying for this, Clark Gable and William Holden, and they were thinking of a lot of different big names for it. That character has such an interesting arc. You know, he's this bigoted cattleman,
yes,
but then through the influence of his wife, you know, he realizes that he's, you know, racist and that he's got some sexist viewpoints. And later in the film, he starts to have these little epiphanies about, you know, he may be in charge of so much, but he's really misusing his power in so many ways.
Well, the son ends up marrying a Mexican woman, and she gets mistreated, and he, mm-hmm, you know, he really takes up for her in a physical
way.
No,
it's
so,
like,
yeah,
his own, it's like, yeah, it's like the cattleman's own bigotry and prejudice is coming home to him,
yes,
literally, you know. And Rock knew that this was a golden opportunity to show that he could really carry a heavyweight project like this, a prestige drama.
Yeah, because he had to go from young to older, yes.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention in reference to that, Grace, that it was an earlier film, The Lawless Breed, 1952, where Rock played the outlaw John Wesley Hardin, who has to age in that film. And by all accounts, George Stevens or one of his associates had seen The Lawless Breed and said, have you thought about Rock Hudson? Because I just saw this and he aged and did it very convincingly and showed a lot of maturity when he played the older version of the character. So that came into play when they were thinking of casting Bic Benedict. And, you know, of course, the other thing that happens is here's the Hollywood manufactured leading man, Rock Hudson, being thrown into the same film with the rebel from the Actors Studio, James Dean, who's kind of the next up and coming. Everybody is starting to talk about Jimmy Dean because East of Eden has been shot, but it hasn't been released. But already there's this big buzz that here's the new kid to watch out for. He's
amazing. Rebel Without a Cause, was that released?
I don't think it was.
Isn't
I don't
that
think
funny?
It had been.
None of them.
When they were shooting Giant. Yeah.
And they didn't get along, right?
They did not, and there's all these theories as to why they didn't get along. Were they vying for the attention of not only George Stevens, but Elizabeth Taylor, because Taylor had bonded with Rock first, and then here comes Jimmy Dean, and he's trying to sort of steal Elizabeth away.
And
he's awful. Yes. And then I think it's also, you know, here's an actor, a real actor, quote-unquote, coming from the Actors Studio, and you have Rock Hudson, who's been sort of raised on the back lot at Universal. So are there conflicts based upon that? Is this part of the rivalry about this? And, you know, is Elizabeth getting caught between these two guys? You know, are they vying for her attention all the time? So it's just an interesting dynamic. And I think Rock is on record. I think I quote him in the book as saying he didn't find Jimmy Dean especially professional. Particularly when they were on location in Marfa, Texas in the sweltering heat.
Yuck.
And Jimmy Dean would keep the whole company waiting while
he was
trying
Maryland,
to quote, unquote,
get into character. Yeah, get into character.
Right.
And
in 100
you know,
degree heat.
That kills me because you know what? Rock Hudson was a great actor. I thought he was a very good actor. Maybe he's not the greatest actor in the world, but he was a good actor. And he didn't have to say, what is my motivation? What is this? He acted. And this whole pretentious, like, Marlon Brando, James Dean, you know, coming in like they're, you know. But look at The Wild One, Marlon Brando, and the, you know, and all the motorcycle guys are in these, like, stupid costume, you know. You know, they're all in uniform, and that's so stupid, and whatever.
Yeah.
But to...
It's interesting, Grace. A number of my interview subjects, I'm glad you pointed this out, because the sort of the tide has started to turn where people would have thought, and this is not to take anything away from Brando or Jimmy Dean, they're magnificently talented actors.
Very.
But they're oftentimes showing, indicating that they're acting, or the performances are very showy or mannered, whereas if you look at Rock now, he's very restrained, and it oftentimes seems... at least from our perspective, maybe sometimes more authentic. Because
definitely, to me.
They're not showboaty performances. They seem pretty human.
Yes, you know? Like real. Well, you see James Dean and I, you know, he was a really good actor. But, you know, you could see him when he'd grab his hair and, you know, whatever. It was very... supposed to be real and, oh, the sensitive guy kind of thing, or with Marlon. And then look at Marlon. He ended up being Superman's father in Kryptonland or whatever, and very obese.
Right.
So, you know what?
Right.
What do you know? But I think they were a little overrated in the fact that they were method actors. I think that a lot of the actors did amazing work, and they, you know, they weren't trained, but they did really great stuff. That's why I love classic film. I mean, they were just amazing, and they were real, and they were comfortable and nice stories. So Giant was great, and that's basically, to me, to say that's where he became great friends with Elizabeth.
Dame Elizabeth, yeah. They remained close friends for the rest of his life, and of course, towards the end of his life, she's incredibly valiant.
She was his champion. Totally his champion.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we get there, let's talk about a few of the movies he did and Mark Christian and his diagnosis. So he does, what is it, Pretty Maids, All in a Row, and Avalanche? An embryo.
Right, so some of these... Yeah, we're kind of getting to the end of things in terms of the film career. Pretty Maids All in a Row does have some champions. Quentin Tarantino thinks it's a magnificent movie, but it's a Roger Vadim film, and it has a great cast. Angie Dickinson, Roddy McDowall, Keenan Wynn, Rock is playing the heavy for a change.
Yes.
By today's politically correct standards, it wouldn't fly. You know, it... there's a lot of shots of young women being ogled. It's almost like the camera is leering at them.
They're bouncing bosoms.
Exactly.
They're tight buttocks.
Really exactly.
Yeah.
It really divided the critics. Like, you know, Rex Reed absolutely loathed it. But then you would have, like, you know, some of the more influential critics, like the New York Times, I think I quote in the book, thought it was terrific, and that it was this brilliantly witty satire, and that Rock was never better than playing the villain.
And he had a
which
fling.
Is not something you would...
No, you'd never think of him as that.
Right, yes. But and yes, I think there was a fling with John David Carson.
Thought he was not bi, just gay. I always just thought that he was. But I liked him a lot. He did some good stuff, and he was a cutie.
Mm-hmm. He sure did.
He was a very cute guy. And then Rock, because it was true, Rock said disaster films are in, and they were. You know, there was Earthquake, there was a Towering Inferno, Poseidon Adventure. So Rock decided to do Avalanche.
Right, and as Tom Clark put it, it really turned out to be a disaster. Not,
not a movie that was disaster movie, right. Horrible.
Yeah, this is where... Yeah, it's a Roger Corman extravaganza, and Roger Corman being Roger Corman, I think, cut some corners in terms of the budget so that the special effects were not all that they could have been, and Rock is kind of, his leading lady is a much younger Mia Farrow, and even physically they
who knew
don't
that?
Look right,
yeah.
Right, they don't look right together on screen in the sense.
Like her and Frank Sinatra. They just didn't
right.
look right.
She's very fragile and waif-like, and then she's up against this huge hunk. You know?
I did not know it was Mia in that film. I would have never cast those two together, ever in a million years.
Yeah, and I think this was, 78? So it's the period right before Mia has her career resurgence via Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a good choice, and I'm trying to remember. It did have its champions. Robert Osborne thought that Rock made, like, a good yell into the telephone tycoon. But most of the critics really crucified it. You know, it was just. But then he does come back a little bit. There's The Mirror Cracked, which is kind of a fun film. It's one of those all-star.
Yeah, I love that with Elizabeth Taylor, Kim Novak, and Rock. But it was allegedly based on what really happened to Jean Tierney when Jean Tierney mm-hmm. was a young star. Gorgeous. Right. I love Jean Tierney. She went, I don't know where she was, the canteen or something. And this woman who was not supposed to go, she had like measles. And Jean was pregnant. Yeah, she was quarantined, but she wanted to meet her favorite star. So she went out, and Jean ended up having the measles. And her child, she was pregnant. Her child was learning to say, just really in bad shape because of this selfish woman. And later, the woman said, hey, she ran into her. It was so weird years later. And the woman told her that she had the measles and she ran into her. So it was based on that film. So nobody knew who the murderer was. Why was this person poisoned? Whatever. But it was based on that story. And I loved The Mirror Cracked. I thought it was really a fun movie.
Yeah, and he's reteamed with Elizabeth. And just a little interesting bit of trivia for your listeners, the screenwriter of The Mirror Cracked, Barry Sandler, told me that the original casting for like the pill-addicted actress that Elizabeth plays, the original casting was going to be Natalie Wood.
Oh.
And apparently, yeah, she didn't quite hit it off with the director, so she dropped out. And then they said, well, who could we get? And then Elizabeth Taylor was married to John Warner at the time and not too happy living in Washington.
Can you blame her? Or Virginia. That's when she got fat, her fat time, her very fat and unhappy time. Yeah, I don't blame
right.
her. Right. Yeah.
So with this opportunity to reunite with Rock on screen came about, she jumped at it. And aren't we glad she did? I think she's marvelous in it.
She is. And I just love that film. And then his final film, I think, was Embryo. Was that his final film?
Well, the final one is The Ambassador, which was filmed in Israel with Robert Mitchum and Ellen Burstyn. And not many people have seen that.
I've never even heard of it, actually. I read, you know, in your book about it and that he and Robert Mitchum did not get along. But that Ellen Burstyn was very kind and it wasn't a good time for him. I read that. Yeah.
Right. He's out there in a small trailer in the desert.
Oh, yeah. Like as a nobody when he's used to being a star.
Right.
Yeah.
And he kind of, I wouldn't say groveled, but he really begged for this kind of small supporting role that Telly Savalas, if you can imagine,
had actually in your book,
turned it down.
Yeah.
And Rock was so desperate to do another feature that he said, I really want that part. And that even the director tried to talk him out of it by saying, well, you know, it's not much of a part, Rock. We'd have to kind of beef it up for you to kind of explain why is Rock Hudson in this very secondary role. And it wasn't a happy experience. It's almost like a direct-to-video film. It did have a limited theatrical run, but, you know, most people don't even remember. Even diehard Rock Hudson fans sort of have forgotten about
it. I never heard of it until you talked about it in your book. I never knew about that. During that period, is that when the guy that sued him for stuff after he died?
Mark Christian.
Was that when Rock went to go to his movie and Mark didn't even come home and Rock cried? He left that day. Was that the film?
Right. Yes, that is. Rock's estate manager, Marty Flaherty, told me that very poignant story where I think Hudson was leaving to go on location. He was going to fly off to Israel to shoot The Ambassador to Tel Aviv. And the night before, I think Rock was eagerly anticipating the return of his live-in companion at the time, Mark Christians, very handsome.
Very young.
Intelligent young guy, yeah. And who had kind of a questionable past, but nevertheless, Rock had fallen hard because this Mark Christian was very much like his ideal man.
Definitely. I mean, tall, blonde, mustache, very, very masculine.
Mm-hmm. The Marlboro man. Like, it's
big time.
Idealized version
big
of
time.
Him. Yep. And Marty Flaherty, who was Rock's handyman at the time, now later became his estate manager, remembered that Rock began crying because Christian hadn't come home to sort of bid him goodbye. And he said that was the only time that he remembered seeing Hudson getting that emotional. So obviously in the beginning, it was an important relationship to Rock. It definitely went south later on when Rock came back. And I think some details or questions about Mark Christian's history started to trouble Rock and a lot of the people that were working or living in the castle.
Well, they said that he had been, he sold himself for money to a lot of rich men.
Allegedly.
And so,
right.
In the, you know, the guys, obviously Mark Miller and George Nader did not like him. And, allegedly, there's different stories where he told Rock.
Yeah. Most people that I interviewed, I'm just going to put it on the table, did not like Mark Christian.
Well, I didn't either when I read the book. Yuck. Yeah.
Right.
There were
maybe one or two people that came to his defense and said, well, you know, it wasn't all black and white. But I think for the most part, what I heard from many of those closest to Hudson was that they felt that Christian was opportunistically taking advantage of that relationship after a time. It may have been genuine in the beginning, we don't know, but their position was that, I think the term gold digger was used at one point.
Well, it sure sounds like it. So when Rock came home from the ambassador... doing the ambassador. Mm-hmm. Isn't that when he had lost a bunch of weight?
Right. It suddenly becomes very evident, you know, his suddenly he's quite gaunt and he looks sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Weathered or ravaged. And he's lost a lot of weight. And when he goes to a state dinner at the White House, his friend Nancy Reagan notices this blemish on his neck, or I think photographs are taken.
Yeah.
And then later when she sends them to him, she points this out and said, you should have that checked, which is something that other people at the house had said. And finally, he was motivated to go and have it looked at, and it was a dermatologist who first made the HIV diagnosis.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, because it was Kaposi sarcoma?
Kaposi sarcoma.
Which was big. Right. That used to show up on the head, the face, and all over their body. And, but at that time, there was a point that they had this honeymoon period. And, mm-hmm. but in your book, right. you said it was because, you know, he got everything he wanted. He just got spoiled up the wazoo.
Yeah, I think Mark Christian, as I mentioned, was a very handsome guy, so was probably
incredibly
used to
handsome.
A lot of attention.
Yes.
Yeah, getting he almost looks like a movie star.
He does.
You know, probably was used to being lavished. And I think when Rock would fall for someone, he would fall very hard. And this was certainly an example of that. And I think when he does return, you know, certain people are saying things to Rock like, well, we've heard thus and such about Mark Christian's history before he knew you, and there are a lot of rumors about him, and what's this whole scenario with this older woman, Liberty Martine, that he hangs out
That's
with?
That's funny.
That, all about?
That he lived with for a while, right?
Yeah, and people described her to me as like kind of a wild Norma Desmond type. You know, she would go in for the whole 30s Hollywood glamour look when this was the 1980s. So she kind of looks like Alexis Carrington on Dynasty. but, you know, poor Rock is in decline at this point, and he's horrified when he gets this devastating diagnosis because in those days, you know, they hadn't yet found these pharmaceutical cocktails that could keep people alive.
And they also didn't know anything. People were afraid that it says in your book that people thought even talking on the phone, perhaps the germs could go through the phone and kill them. People didn't know right. how it was transmitted. People thought if you drank from the same glass, if you chewed, whatever, that you could get AIDS because it was such a new disease and people were ignorant to it. No one knew.
Yeah, this whole hysteria and stigma surrounding AIDS, this is what ignites the whole controversy where he very chastely kissed Linda Evans in an episode of Dynasty.
Yes, that's his last appearance on Celluloid was Dynasty.
Right. He had this recurring role on the show, and they had hoped that he would do more. But, of course, at that point, he was too ill to continue. And,
right.
You know, I think in his defense, even Linda Evans has said, well, you know, it was the most chaste kiss I ever received in my life. It was like on the side of my mouth, practically. And he did everything humanly possible to protect me. This was at a time when people wondered if through something as innocuous as a handshake or a kiss,
and a little saliva gets into you or whatever, that you would get it. And that was a huge brouhaha when they found out that Rock had AIDS. So
why don't firestorm.
Big time. So why don't you tell everybody about his final year about AIDS and how the public got knowledge of it, who took care of him, the whole nine yards. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. It is, as you said, it's a very sad finale for someone that was so beloved. He has been going back and forth between the United States and Paris, and he's, as I mentioned, taking these experimental injections, HPA 23, I think mm-hmm. they were called. And he's seeing this, it's a gentleman named Dr. Dominique Dormat, I mm-hmm. hope I'm giving that the correct Parisian accent, a specialist at a biomedical clinic in Paris that at mm-hmm. that time was a... Yeah, there we go.
You gave it. Grace. We, yeah.
That was at the time, this clinic was at the forefront of AIDS research. And I think at one time, Dr. Dormat, Rock's close friend, and his secretary, Mark Miller, and Hudson's French publicist, who's a woman named Yanou Color, had all attempted to have Hudson transferred to the Percy Military Hospital in France. And so in July of 85, Rock's longtime publicist, Dale Olson, sends a telegram to the White House asking if a high-ranking official might be able to sort of exercise some influence mm-hmm. and have Hudson transferred to this other hospital. And now, sadly, as the story goes, I think the deputy press secretary at the time in the Reagan White House was a guy Berg, and he consulted with the First Lady, showed her the telegram, and her response was, well, this is not something that the White House should get into. And she instructed that they refer to the publicist to the U.S. Embassy in Paris. So here again, we're seeing on a much more elevated level, if you will, how people are reacting or not reacting to the AIDS epidemic. And then Rock, with a young companion, travels to Paris for another series of injections, and he collapses at the hotel that he's staying at and then ends up in the hospital. And this is in July of 85. And not long before, he had, perhaps not wisely, agreed to do a taping for Doris Day's new series.
Oh, boy, I remember that, yeah.
And then we see these heartbreaking kind of final images of him looking almost cadaverous.
Oh, it was so sad. And there's Doris looking up at him adoringly, and it must have been breaking her heart, you know, to see her friend like that. But, you know, he looks so much older. Jeez, I didn't know. How old was he when he died, 58?
He was 59, so he was just a few, about several weeks actually short of his 60th birthday.
He looked so much older at that time, and that was so sad. Did his young companion who went to Paris with him when Rock fainted and just was terrible, mm-hmm. did he know that Rock was there for AIDS treatment?
I think that, yeah, this is a young gentleman named Ron Chanel who Rock had befriended. We're not exactly sure what all the circumstances of that relationship mm-hmm. were. It's kind of questionable.
Yeah.
But by all accounts, Chanel was not made aware that Rock was going to Paris for these treatments. Mm-hmm. And I think that Mark Miller, the secretary, and Rock would sort of use these coded terms, like we're going to Paris for script conferences, rather than saying I'm having injections to combat HIV. So to the best of my knowledge, Ron Chanel was not aware of all of that. I tried to get Chanel to talk to me for the book, but he was one of the few that did not cooperate.
Hmm. So,
And that's his choice, certainly.
Of course.
And, you know, this was an episode much earlier in his life, and maybe he's just moved on from all of it. And then sadly, you know, Rock ends up being flown home on a 747 after much wrangling over that, and how are they going to get him home. And he's in the hospital at UCLA for a time. And then he decides that he wants to go back home to the castle. And this is when the longtime companion, Tom Clark, is welcomed back in, even though it's kind of an odd scenario because the more recent companion, Mark Christian, that we mentioned, is also still living.
And he ain't leaving. His lawyer said, don't move. He ain't leaving.
Right. He's dug in there. And, I mean, it just must have created kind of a very surreal environment, I can imagine. And there's a lot of strong personalities surrounding
Rock. Well, the
Rock
two, the Mark Miller and George Nader, who took over, and basically they changed the will and they became the recipients.
Allegedly.
Right. Yeah, allegedly. I'm going to say allegedly. And they became the recipients. But it's just all, you know, it's, but, you know, as little money goes or as big money goes, I have seen people become monsters when someone dies, no matter what the dough is. They are just so horrifyingly greedy. It's despicable. But anyway, we're going. So Rock goes home and then he never leaves there again, does he?
He doesn't, no. And, you know, he is visited by some of the nearest and dearest. These are, I think, where you could kind of discern who the true friends were. Who
yes.
Really showing up at the end.
Not being afraid, just loving their friend. And Elizabeth was wonderful. She, what'd she say? Everybody's all afraid. She went in and got into bed with him and held him. And I love her. I mean, what a beautiful thing to do for your friend and say, F it. I love my friend, and he needs me, and I'm going to cuddle with him. And that was beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, and I think it's Rock's death, and also Elizabeth has lost a couple of male assistants.
Oh, yes, so
I think all of this really galvanized her, and that's when she became very militant about, you know, wanting to establish an AIDS foundation and getting a lot of her celebrity friends together to do benefits, because without her, a lot of that would not have occurred.
No, she was amazing. She was such a champion. Also, Rock was in and out. Sometimes he didn't recognize people. Sometimes he did. He had his good days, his bad days, and he had gotten incredibly thin. I think you said 97 pounds or something, like 6'5", Rock. When did the public find out that Rock had AIDS?
I think that comes in July of 85. There's sort of embedded in a lot of people's memories is that French publicist Yanou Kalour outside of the American hospital in Paris reading this announcement, because there had been all this speculation, like, we know Rock Hudson is being treated for some sort of mystery illness. And, you know, some people had rumored that it was liver cancer, and other people said it was some sort of anorexia nervosa. And
the watermelon diet, like Liberace.
Yeah. Right. And so she makes this stunning announcement, and the press, you know, understandably, there's this worldwide frenzy over it. But that's when the public first learned of this. And, you know, it's very poignant that Rock believed that when his legions of fans found out that he did have this dreaded disease, that they were going to turn their backs on him. And what is really reassuring or reaffirming is that he received some 30,000 letters of support, you know, from everyone from Madonna down
wonderful.
You know, a housewife in Peoria who loved Magnificent Obsession. Yeah.
But it's fun. And then you write, because I, you know, the Holy Rollers come in, Shirley and Pat Boone and Gavin McLeod and his wife, and they all just come over and pray over Rock, and they fast to try to cure Rock and do all these things. And, you know, other people like Elizabeth would come in and be like, oh, my God, you know, because it's like voodoo almost. And Rock had a priest come in to see him. And was that Tom Clark who brought him in, a priest to come in to see him?
Correct. And also Susan Stafford, who had predated Vanna White as the letter turner on Wheel of Fortune, She was brought in to, I think she was friends with the priest, actually. And Susan Stafford had worked with, is it C. Everett Koop, with leprosy patients. So she had a lot of expertise with dealing with people that had been ostracized.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting is you have these religious types coming in at the same time Elizabeth Taylor is visiting. So it is kind of a – I tried to describe in the book that it's very much like a Fellini kind of atmosphere.
You did it very well.
Around Rock.
Yeah, I just felt like I was in the room there too. I just really, got the whole idea of it, that it was like wild. And
it's a microcosm of his life in a way. It's like you have all of these – in many ways, Rock is the central character, but all of these peripheral supporting characters are just every bit as fascinating as he is, and they're all sort of pivoting around him. And it must have seemed at times kind of like a very circus-like atmosphere there.
Especially for someone dying, because when my mom died and there was hospice, I fortunately got to be with her the last week of her life. She understood, but she couldn't talk. And, there's all these people making all these noises, pretending she's not there. And the hospice lady's like, what's going on? And I said, will you please tell them? Because they won't listen to me. And it was like awful. Mm-hmm. And just think of Rock, like he's not really there, but he's there. He's in and out of it. And he's having all this like craziness surrounding him. When really, you need some kind of peace when you die. You don't need all this madness.
Though on a certain level, I think he was sort of used to that kind of circus-like atmosphere around him. And some people wonder, did he at times encourage that? It was almost like being the ringmaster, you have all this drama, rolling out around you.
I just can't imagine as someone dying, just in my eyes, because I've seen people die. What I would want, versus something that you described. So, Rock, this statement that Burt Lancaster read, and I always felt that, Rock didn't write it, because by that time, I think he died very soon after, and that he was not with it. And you, you found out something. Somebody said something about it. So you have sort of your theory on what happened with it. Do you think Rock wrote it?
I do not. That's just a personal opinion. And what we're talking about is that this Commitment of Life Gala, which Elizabeth Taylor and Shirley MacLaine put together, a number of celebrities appeared. And at one point, Burt Lancaster is reading this letter, supposedly written by Rock, where he's thanking everyone there and making this very beautiful statement about everyone's commitment to battling AIDS. And later this controversy erupts where the producer, Ross Hunter, particularly, who had produced Pillow Talk and a lot of Rock's hits, had said, the Rock that I've been visiting wouldn't be lucid enough to make that sort of statement on his own. So obviously this was written by somebody else. And I think Tom Clark admitted that it was written by Hudson's publicist, Dale Olson. Mm-hmm. But as Clark put it, can't we say that that's what Rock would have wanted to say in this scenario? And I think what they were grasping at there is there were fears that the AIDS epidemic going the way it was, they weren't getting the support that they needed from the administration in Washington in any way.
No, they were totally ignoring it. Mm.
Right. They needed a big name on the level of Rock Hudson to sort of galvanize
put a face people to people. Somebody people cared about. Somebody people knew, it was just somebody else. I don't know these people. I don't care. I'm not whatever. But he put the face, a human face to it. But I didn't think he wrote it either, because I think he died pretty soon after, and I don't think he was lucid either. That's just my thoughts. I wasn't there, obviously, and you went through and researched it a lot more than
right.
me.
Right. And we should also mention, too, before Rock's death, the administration in Washington had recommended a $10 million cut in AIDS funding to the federal
goodness.
Budget. After his death, there was suddenly this complete 360, and the House of Representatives announced that it was doubling AIDS-related funding allotting over $100 million to HIV prevention and education efforts. So there you have not only how powerful a celebrity can be, but Rock Hudson's distinctive celebrity.
Beloved. He was so beloved. And it just makes you sad that, you know, through his life he had to hide so many things. And but, you know, his legacy is that he really put a face and put people, like you said, giving the money, getting that research money out, which, you know, he didn't want to ever be found out, I don't think. But, you know, he really did. So when did he finally die? Who was he alone? Was somebody with him?
At the time that he passed away, Tom Clark was there with him at the time. And I think I say in the book at the very end, Tom says, like, do you want another cup of coffee? I'm going to go downstairs and get one. And Rock just musters up enough energy to say something like, I don't believe so. And then it's all over. And then comes, you know, this whole scenario with the memorial and how that should be handled.
He didn't want one, right? He didn't want one. He just wanted to be cremated.
At best he wanted, you know, people to be on a yacht and exchange a few funny stories.
Yes.
Sip some champagne. And then they thought about having the burial at Gracelawn, which is kind of the more typical Hollywood way to say goodbye to someone. And then Elizabeth Taylor again stepped in and said, no, we're going to have this memorial at the castle. We're going to have, you know, we're going to toast him and we're going to do it the way that he would have liked it. And I think most of the people that I interviewed agreed that she had the right idea because it took it away from being in a more public forum like Grace
Vaughn. Yeah, more personal, more quiet, more what he wanted.
Exactly. Yeah. And they had a few close friends like Carol Burnett or John Shuck got up and either told poignant anecdotes or they actually performed songs. And the people that I interviewed that were there said it was very moving and it was probably exactly the tribute that Rock himself would have appreciated the most. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing that at least at the very end, he was afforded that kind of dignity and respect.
Yes, and then the story wasn't over because Mark Christian then sued his estate.
Right, and this becomes hugely controversial.
Big time tabloid stuff. He's all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to think of how this goes, the timeline for this. So Christian contended, I think it was a multi-million-dollar lawsuit.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, he alleged that Rock continued to have sex with him, knowing his HIV diagnosis until like June of 1984, somewhere in there. And then whereas Hudson had told his close friends that he did not have any relations with Christian after he learned of his illness. So then comes, you know, this huge courtroom battle, and it drags on until 1989, I think it is. Yes. And the court finally decided in Christian's favor, but then later there was a remitter action to the lawsuit, I think is the correct term, where the initial judgment was dramatically decreased because individuals had come forward who were challenging Christian's contention that he was so terrified about contracting AIDS that he had no sexual relationships with any other partners beyond Rock. And I think one of my interview subjects came in and challenged this. And
he had a relationship with Mark too, right? Mark kind of used him for information, and he... they had like this short-lived thing, and then Mark, you know, went to the suit thing. And the guy didn't talk right away, but then he did finally.
Right, and he, you know, spoke up because he said, you know, where were all of Rock's friends, all of these supporters, when his name was being sullied and dragged through the mud during this whole trial? No one was sort of, even in his death, standing up for Rock Hudson. So it's a very messy, complicated scenario, and I tried to examine it fairly from every possible angle.
You
in
did.
The book. Oh, thank you. I tried. I strive to do that. And there are, you know, it's fair to say there are certain questions about Rock Hudson's life that are probably never going to be definitively answered because they're shrouded in so much mystery. And, you know, we only Hudson himself probably would know the real answer to something.
Definitely. Only he. And
challenging
you
questions.
Don't know. Because
yeah.
In the beginning, truly, you know, if that's the truth, if he had sex with that guy after he knew he had AIDS, that's a horrible thing. You know, you just, you know, you don't do that.
Mm-hmm. It's unconscionable, and it would sound very uncharacteristic of the Rock Hudson that has been described to me by so many people. It just doesn't sound...
Yeah, and the other guy just sounds like such a eek, you know, that it's just like... Mm-hmm. But, you know, who knows? That's all we can say. Your book was fair. It was very good. I enjoyed it.
Oh,
like
thank you,
Leonard
Grace.
Maltin said, a page-turner. It is a page-turner. And you get to learn a lot about Rock. And if you like him, you'll love him. And if you love him, you'll love him even more. And watch out for that movie. We're going to see who's going to be cast as Rock. Let's hope it's somebody really Rock-worthy. And
wouldn't it be interesting, Grace, if it was a newcomer? You know, like, or someone we didn't know all
I think
well.
It would be good if it was a newcomer who just kind of, you know, didn't have any backstory, didn't have anything. I would love that, but they'd have to really look. They'd really have to look because
yeah.
Rock was one in a million.
I'm kind of rooting for the Vivian Leigh scenario.
Yes.
The best choice is just going to sort of emerge out of nowhere in a way.
I hope so, because it's such a great story, and he was such a great guy, and such an interesting person. I would advise anybody that this is a wonderful book. Mark really, really, really worked on it. Like you said, 4 years. That's a heck of a lot of time. And the name of the book is All That Heaven Allows, and I love that name because I love that movie, A Biography of Rock Hudson, and it will be a major motion picture with a mystery guy starring in the role. And, Mark, you were fabulous. I'm going to cut this into two parts because we went over 2 hours because people sometimes don't want to listen to a podcast. It's 2 hours, but it's compelling, mm-hmm. and... you were wonderful, and I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I enjoyed this immensely, and you did a great job on your book, and I just wish you just only good things. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Grace. You were thoroughly delightful, and I so appreciate you having me on. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and I had a ball. You know, it's just so fun to learn about these people that I love. And because I adore classic movies. He also wrote a book about Vincente Minnelli. So if you want to look at that, I will link you up. I'm going to link you up. Do you have anything else? Do you want me to link you up your webpage or anything else?
If you could, HarperCollins would love that. I can send you this in an email too. It's www.markgriffinauthor.com.
Okay, so just send me the link. I think that's how I sent you an email too, because I found you on,
yes.
I follow you now on Amazon, but I will link people up to there. And thank you so much. You were fabulous. And
my
thanks,
pleasure,
you guys.
Grace.
Oh, you're great. Thanks, you guys, for listening. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll have another great guest for you. Mark was fab. Thanks, guys. Thank you, Mark. Bye, everybody.
Are we really happy here with this lonely game we're playing? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding understanding anywhere. We're lost in a masquerade. Both afraid to say. the way. We're lost inside this lonely game we play. Hearts of weeping disappear every time I see your eyes. No matter how hard I try, ooh, 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 to understand the reasons that we carry on this way. We're lost in a man.